We are starting a whole new series this week, and it's on the other apostles. These are books attributed to James, John, Peter, and Jude. And they are all short little books. Three of them are only a page long. We're going to start with the longest one of all, the book of James, which has five chapters. So, which James was it who wrote the book? Well, the short answer is we don't know. You may have been taught that it was written by the James who was the brother of Jesus. That James was the recognized leader of the faith community in Jerusalem and was one of the leaders who listened to Paul's plea in 57 and 58 common era. And he, as basically an elder in the church, agreed to write to the churches to tell them that Gentiles should be accepted into the Christian faith communities without having to convert to Judaism first. That's that James. Most scholars do not think it was that James. Some do, but most do not.
Look
And
at my
there's
hearing aids.
several reasons. One is that the Greek is too good for a poor carpenter's son. Now, I personally am not a good enough Greek scholar to opine on that judgment. I have to rely on the word of scholars who are. In this case, and for the points that follow about authorship of James, my comments are based on one of the textbooks I studied in seminary. It was called The New Testament Methods and Meanings. It was written by Warren Carter and Amy Jill Levine, and it was published by Abingdon Press in 2013. The chapter on James is found in pages 283 to 297. So, in addition to the Greek being too good, Carter and Levine note that the author himself doesn't mention he's the brother of Jesus. Instead, he simply says he is a doulos, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. So it seems like he might have mentioned that he was the brother of Jesus if he was. I personally think one of the best points the authors of the textbook make is that throughout the book, James specifically addresses problems that arose in the early church due to misapplication of Paul's teachings, specifically misunderstandings around faith and works. And he is, of course, correcting the churches for how they are using Paul's letters. And if that's the case, he'd likely have to be writing sometime after those letters were written, after Paul has died. Some time has had to pass for the churches to, go astray here. But James, the brother of Jesus, was killed 2 years before Paul was, while Paul was still in prison in Rome and still presumably writing the letters. So could the author still be the brother of Jesus? Yes, but it would be a stretch given all these reasons taken together. So who else could it be? Could it be James, the disciple of Jesus, the brother of John, the son of Zebedee, one of the ones Jesus nicknamed Son of Thunder, the one who had the pushy mother? Well, it's even more unlikely that it would be this James because he was killed by Herod Agrippa in the persecution of the Christians in Jerusalem nearly 20 years earlier than James, the brother of Jesus, and Paul were killed. So, what other James could it be? The answer is we simply don't know. What we do know is the book of James came late to the canon of accepted books of the Bible. During the first 300 years of Christianity, different church leaders had different lists of which books they thought were to be used as reliable sources for the early church. There were some core books that most folks agreed on. But books like James were definitely on the bubble. The list I tend to use as an example is the list Eusebius provided Emperor Constantine around 320 to 330 Common Era. What I love about his list is that he broke it up into four pieces: the books that he considered as canon, the books that were still being hotly disputed, the books that were definitely not canon but were still helpful to read, and then the books that were heretical and should be avoided. Guess where James is on this list? Yep, he's on the hotly disputed list, along with Jude, 2 Peter, 2 and 3 John, and a book we don't have a copy of called the Gospel of Hebrews. We don't have that one anymore. We don't know what that is. Another famous list called the Muratorian Canon completely excludes James. That list was compiled around 200 Common Era and is the earliest list we've got. So that's two votes against James being canon, and though they are earlier votes, but later lists we have from Athanasius and Cyril of Jerusalem, trying to remember where he was from, include James in the canon. So both of these later lists match what we now have in our Bibles. We have James in our Bibles, except that Cyril's list omits Revelation. So, Revelation continued to be on the bubble even as late as Cyril's list. So, one of the things that Carter and Levine point out is that even as late as 1522, when Martin Luther published his New Testament translation, he moved James, Jude, Hebrews, and Revelation to the end. Just lumped them all at the end, did not give them page numbers in the table of contents. I think that is fascinating. And that further confirms the tenuous status of these books. Luther called James a, quote, letter of straw because it doesn't have anything about the gospel in it. That's so interesting. So let's get to this controversial book and see what it says. I think it's easiest to approach James by theme rather than chapter by chapter because he really rambles around. I see three main themes. You may see others. The one that James is definitely famous for is faith. The other two main themes I see are perseverance and humility. We're going to see James talk about how these three main characteristics of a Christian overlap and enhance each other. But let's start with his words on faith, as these are some of his most famous words. In chapter one, he says, "Don't just listen to the word, be doers of the word. If you are just a hearer but not a doer, then you're like a person who sees themselves in the mirror and then goes off and forgets what they look like." He's saying that the word, specifically the preaching and teaching of it, will show you who you really are. But if all you do is hear that and then forget about it, you'll never actually become who you are meant to be in this world. In chapter two, he expands on this, saying, "What's the point of someone saying they have faith if they don't also have works?" And this is really important because it lines up exactly with Jesus' teachings, right? In a nutshell, faith produces. It changes us. It moves us. It is the mustard seed that becomes a great tree. It moves mountains. It doesn't just admire them. And this seems to bring James into direct opposition to Paul's teachings about faith and grace, doesn't it? In Romans 11, Paul talks about how God saved a remnant of Israel by grace, even through all the death and destruction they'd suffered over the millennia. And if he saved them by grace, it can't be by works. Furthermore, he saved them because of his own grace and not because of anything they'd done. He literally uses the same word for works here, that God's grace, they're saved by God's grace and not human works, can't be works, all these works. This is the same word that James uses. And in Ephesians 2, which was probably not written by Paul, but is still received as canon in the church, the author says, "It is by grace you are saved by faith." And even that's not your own faith, it's a gift. You are saved by that gift and not by works. So, how do we reconcile these two viewpoints? The key is that Paul saw salvation as something that would happen in the end time at the last day when Jesus returns. Salvation would be a literal rescue of Israel from the hands of their enemies, and it would be a gift from God, not something anyone deserved. Baptism was seen by Paul as a threshold we could cross now, an entry into a new way of being that was focused on God. At baptism, you literally became part of a movement that they called, quote, the way. Paul taught people to cling to their coming salvation, to look forward to it, to hope in it. Paul expected Jesus to come immediately. So this teaching made perfect sense from that point of view. But we're now down the road a few years, and James is addressing people who are believers, but are sitting around looking at the sky, waiting for salvation, and doing nothing. They are not being changed, and they are certainly not being of any use to those around them. James is saying, yeah, it's great you have faith, but faith is pointless if it's not producing. And we can see this difference in viewpoint by comparing how Paul and James use the same example, the example of Abraham. In Romans 4, Paul calls to mind the time God told Abraham to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice, even though that would nullify God's earlier promise that through this son Isaac, Abraham was going to have multitudes of descendants. At this point, Isaac was a young teen and had no children. Paul says that even in that moment of contradiction, Abraham still believed God's promise and had enough faith in God to go forward with offering Isaac as a sacrifice. And God saw Abraham's faith and credited it to Abraham as righteousness, which in the Hebrew Bible meant that God recognized that Abraham had fully upheld and completed his end of the bargain, even though in the end, God, of course, stopped Abraham from going through with the sacrifice. James uses this same example. He also says that Abraham was considered righteous because he offered his son on the altar. But James points out it was not just Abraham's faith in play here. It was his actions that accompanied his faith. He actually set out on a long trip with his son, with some kindling and a knife in tow. And he, probably with Isaac's help, built that altar, and Isaac got up on it and let his father bind him. James says it was his actions working with his faith that made his faith complete. I think Paul would be totally on board with James. I'm less sure of what James might think about Paul. James doesn't focus on grace at all, at least not in this book. I, for one, am thankful for Paul's moderating point of view because I, too, believe that there is nothing we can do to merit being loved by God and dwelling with God. That part is a great gift. But if you read Paul's life, you see that he took action for granted. I don't think it would ever occur to Paul to just sit around and do nothing once you were a believer. His books are full of exhortations to live a changed life and to live it fully. It was the folks who read his letters who got the idea they should just have faith and wait around for salvation. James puts it well when he says, faith without works is dead. And faith is on James's mind as he ends his little book. He says, "Prayer matters. If you're in trouble, pray. If you're happy, sing prayers of praise. If someone is sick, pray for them. Confess your sins to each other so you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous person is powerful and is made effective." Elijah, the famous prophet, was just a person just like us. He prayed for the rain to stop, and it stopped for 3.5 years. Then he prayed for the rain to start up again, and it did. Now, James' points on faith are really important. If you are a believer, but there is no fruit of the Spirit in your life, and you're not helping anyone in any practical way, your faith is dead. And if you are a believer, pray in all circumstances. Ask each other for prayer. Freely support each other with prayer, especially in times of weakness. So let's move on to James' second big theme, which is perseverance. There are many things that this little believing community could be suffering that would make perseverance essential. Not the least of which was waiting, or, you know, how long it was taking Jesus to come. Although there was not empire-wide persecution at this time, there were definitely pockets of persecution. We don't know exactly where this community was located that his letter is addressed to. May have been in a large urban area, though, because they were being sorely tempted. James tells his flock, "Consider all of these trials and temptations a joy, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, patience, steadfastness. And if you let it, the result will be that you will become whole, complete, fully mature, lacking nothing." Those are comforting words. James seems to have the same view of the interaction between faith and salvation as Paul did, because he continues saying, "Having endured the trials and temptations with a faith that is genuine, you will receive the crown of life that he has promised to those who love him." But James realizes some people might take this the wrong way. They might think that God sends these trials and temptations so our faith will be tested and we will become whole and mature, that because God has tried and tempted us. But God doesn't work this way. God makes us whole and complete by healing us, not by tempting us or testing us. It is just living in the world that causes us to undergo trials and temptations that would draw us away from God. And James wants to clarify this point. He says, don't ever say you are being tempted or tried by God. Evil cannot tempt or try God, and God does not tempt or try us. This is a really important point. So much bad theology comes from missing this point. James goes on to say, our own desire drags us away, and when it has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is fully grown, it gives birth to death. That's exactly what Paul says in Romans 6:23 when he says the wages of sin is death, right? God never does anything that would lead us towards death. God only leads us to life. And I'm not talking about physical death and physical life here. I'm talking deeper than that. James says, don't be fooled, my beloved. Every loving act of generosity, every complete and perfect gift is from the Father above, in whom there is not even a hint of shadow. God intentionally brought us forth by the word of truth to be a special first fruit of his created beings. You already know this, my siblings. We're going to skip ahead to the last chapter where James summarizes his comments on perseverance. He says, "Therefore, be patient as you wait for the coming of the Lord. Like a farmer waits with eager expectation for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for the seasonal rains. The coming of the Lord is near. Do not groan about each other, so you yourself may not be so judged, for the judge is standing at the threshold. Remember the prophets and even Job. You know the end purpose of the Lord. You know that the Lord is extremely compassionate, tenderhearted, and merciful." James is saying that we know this about the Lord, so we too must be exactly this way towards each other. This is the Lord's expectation of us, his will for us. If you wonder what God's will for your life is, it's not whether you take this job or that one. It's that you be extremely compassionate, tender-hearted, and merciful towards everyone else. Everyone, just live like this. James continues, "Human anger does not produce the righteousness or justice of God. So we must all be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to get angry." And this brings us to the final big theme in James, humility. James spends more time on humility than either of the other two themes. In humility, he says, "Let the word be planted in you, so it may save, make whole, preserve your soul." James sees humility as foundational to the life of a Christian. It is the soil in which the seed of the word is planted. Humility nurtures the soul. He tells his flock, "If you are already low on the totem pole of life, rejoice in your high station. And if you are rich, rejoice in your lowliness, for the rich will fade away in the middle of his busyness like grass withered by the sun." Notice the upside-down kingdom of God James describes here. This is the earmark of a teaching thoroughly aligned with Jesus. James makes a huge big deal of how the rich and well-off need to see themselves and treat other people. We've got no whiff of the hierarchies that we saw in some of the pastoral letters and some of those class series. James is really well aligned with Jesus. He says, "If a well-to-do person comes to your church finely dressed, and at the same time, a poor person shows up in stinking clothes, and you put the rich folks up front and shuffle the poor folks off to the side, you have judged each other evilly and not with the faith you hold in Jesus Christ. You have shown partiality and made distinctions among yourselves." Listen to me, James says. Didn't God choose or elect the poor to be rich in faith and to be heirs of the kingdom? The rich are the ones oppressing you, the ones blaspheming the name by which you are called. You must love your neighbor as yourself. If you show partiality, you are breaking the law. And if you break any part of the law, you break it all. You are no better than adulterers or murderers. So speak and act as if you will be judged by the law of liberty, the law that sets people free. For if you show mercy, you will be judged with mercy. For mercy triumphs over judgment. Let that soak in a minute. Mercy triumphs over judgment. That's what Jesus taught too. That's what the entire Hebrew Bible bears witness to. This is the good news of grace that Paul taught. This is the very character and nature of God's judgment and God's justice. This is Gail talking to you here. This is not James. It all boils down to mercy. And thus we must all, in humility, show mercy to each other without exception and without partiality. Then James turns again to the rich to drive his point home. In the last days, you will find, rich folks, that the so-called treasure you have stored up is moth-eaten and rusted. Its very corrosion will bear witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. He's not saying the rich are getting thrown into a burning hell. He's saying that in the last days, their earthly treasures that they value so highly will be shown for what they truly are and completely worthless and corroded. They will be ashamed of their riches. That is how their riches will show how they have wasted their lives. That knowledge will consume them, will consume their flesh like fire. And it will highlight that these are not true treasures that come unscathed through the fire of the Spirit, purifying and shining. And the realization of this truth will be a body blow to the rich. But there's more. Look, James says, the wages you withheld from your laborers cry out, and the cries of the laborers have reached the ear of the Lord. You have lived a life of luxury and self-indulgence. In the day of slaughter, you condemned the righteous, the just, who never did you any wrong in the first place, while you pampered yourself. Don't you know that cozying up to the world is being hostile to God? Do you give no weight to Proverbs 3:34 that says God sets himself against the haughty, but gives charis, grace, his own charisma to the humble? So make yourself subordinate to God. This is so important. We have to stop putting ourselves in God's place. This is what James sees the rich doing over and over. He says, oppose the devil and he will run from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands and purify your hearts, you who are of two minds. Change your joy and laughter into grief and tears. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will lift you up. This is a powerful message directed to the rich and the arrogant. It should be preached from every pulpit. But James does not limit his comments to the rich alone. Just because you're not well off doesn't mean you automatically get it right. You just have different temptations. James sees that the less well off are jealous of the rich, and that this is causing conflict and strife among the believers. So he addresses this too. He says, you don't have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask in order to consume for your own pleasure. That makes sense. And I just want to point out that these verses mean that you don't have because you don't ask God and you don't ask. And when you ask God and do not receive, it's because you asked for the wrong things. But in context, this could just as easily be that these folks don't have because they don't ask the rich. So that sort of asking, whether you ask it of God or the rich, makes us no better than the rich, right? James gives an example saying, don't all of you try to be the teacher. Teachers fall under greater scrutiny or judgment. Of course, we all stumble in many ways. The perfect man, the mature man, is the one able to bridle his tongue. Such a one can control his entire body. It is the same with a bit in a horse's mouth or the rudder on a ship. A small flame kindles a great forest fire. The tongue works exactly the same way. It is such a small part of the body, and yet it is a mighty boaster, full of arrogance. The tongue is unstable, full of deadly venom. No one can tame it. With it we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse our fellow man who is made in God's image. Blessings and curses from the same mouth. Dear ones, it should not be this way. We will be one or the other in truth. Our fruit comes from the state of our heart. And where jealousy and selfish ambition are, there also will be confusion and every other evil thing. This is false wisdom and is against the truth. Rather, the wisdom from above is pure, peaceful, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and without hypocrisy. It is the true, peaceable fruit of righteousness that is sown in peace. In closing, dear ones, if anyone wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, they are saving, healing, rescuing, preserving his soul from death, and are covering over, veiling, concealing a multitude of sins. That is such a beautiful picture of the grace we should have for each other. Let's talk about this in our breakout groups. All right. Hi. Welcome back. This was a little bit different kind of discussion, the way it was set up. Not as many specific kind of questions. Tell me what you all talked about, what you thought.
I'm going to let Julia talk because she had a lot to say.
Sorry, Julia.
Not too small, but we discussed. As far as faith, I jotted down that it motivates us to action. It keeps us from just being. And when you see something you need to act on, you do with faith. It's like the thing that's in the culture right now. See something, say something, you know? Well, there's so much to say right now and to do. And so when you see people being treated in a way that's not positive, your faith is like a compass, a guidance in you that helps you. Now, I'm not saying we have extremes in religion, but I think people who take this to heart and embrace it and want to be like Jesus will do better.
Yeah.
Strive to do better.
Yeah. What did you hear out of the discussion, Julie?
Me?
Yeah, you.
Oh, okay. Out of the discussion?
Yeah, what was it that struck you in the discussion?
One of the things is that they're all like faith leads to perseverance, which leads to humility. So you really can't talk about these things separate from one another. Mm-hmm. And you really have to understand the idea of faith first. And just from my, you know, I had, I taught in a Missouri Synod Lutheran school, and all they ever talked about was grace. You know, that you received this grace not by your own merit. It was so lacking in good works, and they didn't, in this particular church, didn't really even have a social justice program. All they had was Bible study and going to church And that was pretty much it. They didn't really help each other. I just found it to be really oppressive. And so, and then the other thing that came to me was because of the endurance and patience. I'm thinking about the black communities having to endure and be patient through all of these generations. The LGBTQ population now, incredibly, they're being attacked. And they just have to have this endurance and patience, and just the strength in these communities comes from the way they are compassionate and tender-hearted and merciful towards each other, and how they build each other up. And I just see a lot of comfort because right now I've never really had to experience all these things that we're experiencing now in our society with an administration that seems to want to dismantle anything that's good. And I'm very frustrated. But I look at these communities and I draw a lot of hope and strength from them. And I'm humbled, and I'm humbled by them.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I kind of called out that part in James 4 where he says we ask God for stuff and then we think we don't get it because all these reasons and what I was trying to say was it goes beyond just asking God. James talked about just asking God for stuff, but we are the hands and feet of Jesus in the world. And asking each other for things and for help is asking God too. That's part and parcel of it.
One of the things I put under perseverance, well, two of them, were that it provides comfort to us and to others. But then the other thing I put was that we're not to judge, but to be content with our situation. And I was explaining in our group, I come from a history of not having. And I was quite content in my faith with that history. And now I have a position of comfort and somewhat abundance in life. And so what I do with that is important. And knowing that I'm no longer there, I'm here now, and what I can do to help one another.
Yeah, that's
That's
huge,
an
Julia.
important thing.
That's a huge shift.
And I put down for humility that it nurtures our faith, being humil you know, being having humility. And there was so much in humility, we ran out of time. But that
Good. I'm
humility
glad you dwelled
package,
there.
that was a lot.
Marlene, I see your hand up.
Something that came to my mind when you and Julia were talking, that sort of ties together the idea of, you're not receiving because you're not asking, and humility is that there are so many people, and I have been this way at times myself, where we know we need help, but we don't ask for it, either because we see it as a weakness, or because if I do ask for help, people are going to judge, or I should not have to ask for help for this. I should be able to do this on my own. And that is a reflection of a lack of humility, I think. We don't want to be seen as vulnerable often in situations. And if we just sort of let that guard down and say, guys, I'm really struggling. I need help. That's a prayer to God, and that's also an immediate request to those around us who love us. And we say, of course, tell me what you need me to do.
I'm just pretty overwhelmed by everything. I think in many ways that we do take on each of these as an individual, when in reality they should be a communal grouping.
Yeah. I think can we just full stop there and say this is one of the biggest errors Christian communities make, period, across the board, is this individualism that is just anathema to what Jesus taught. Okay, go on, Nar.
Yeah, I think it's real easy to you know, put on the badge of faith, you know, oh, look at me, I'm a Christian. I've got, you know, a cross on at all times and all this. But the bottom line is that actions are where it is. The humility, I think that humility allows us to put ourselves in the position of seeing another's need. And that empathy that grows from that is what makes us a better human being. When we can empathize with others, it allows us to bring forth the message that I think was supposed to be brought forth from the get-go, rather than all this waving our flags and, you know, just the superficial Christianity. That was it.
I think that's such an important point, because part of this individualization of Christianity is silo Christianity, where we build a little silo around ourselves that does not allow us to have contact with people who are not like us. And it is out of that that these horrible activities and actions come that Julie was talking about, where we other people because we don't know them. It's like my heart begs. I see these laws and these bills and these, you know, judgments that are coming down that are just incredibly cruel towards human beings. And I think, if I could just put you in a room, you know, for a month in an environment where those people, whoever you are calling those, are the people that are providing you sustenance, I think your heart would change. I would hope. Joe, unmute yourself.
When you said that, a light bulb went off in my head, because if you know me, you know I love to discuss, debate, and no topic is kind of off limits and go as deep as you want. And I was at a retreat like this a couple years ago, and the funny thing is that the person that got really offended is the one who started the whole thing. And she started talking about how she supports this, that, or the other. And, you know, discussion broke out, and I was very proud of myself, which I know is not a humble thing to say, but I kept really quiet until the end. And then afterwards, I could tell that this woman was just kind of upset. And so after we all left, and I messaged her and said, you know, I was just checking in with you and seeing how you're feeling about this. And she flat up says, I only participate and engage, did she say, with people who are like-minded Christians, and I don't know enough about anything else to feel comfortable to discuss it.
How tragic.
There's your silo.
How tragic.
And it is. And honestly, I would never have thought this about the person saying that until it came out. And I feel that a lot of times for those of us that are passionate or comfortable communicating, talking with people, that instead of that, maybe we need to assess the silo, is what I'm saying, and before we to help us know how to approach it, because a lot of times that's what offends people, is
That's
you said
right.
something
Very
that doesn't agree
often, I mean, we're sending
with me.
messages of, this is wrong, this is wrong, with what they're doing, and they're just bouncing off the silo
Yeah.
because they have no frame of reference. Martha, you have your hand up.
Thanks. So Anne started us down a path that we didn't follow very far that I want to go back to, when it came up about individualism. And I went back and I looked, and James wrote this to the 12 tribes. So he wrote it to a collection, not to an individual, not to individuals in a collection in his greeting. He writes it to community. And I'm thinking about the what happens when a community understands these words as shared faith and shared perseverance and shared humility. And the trouble that's caused when the individual might embrace those things, but the system in which they operate, or attach their identity to does not.
How powerful is that phrase? I don't know that I've ever heard those two words together. Shared humility.
Yeah.
How
Well,
powerful is that?
look at what we say the foundation of our country is. When people go, give us your weak, give us your tired.
Yeah, go ahead, Martha. I did not mean to interrupt you. It was just such a powerful phrase.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to mention, and I'm not sure whether James is also has anything to say about pride. But oftentimes, humility and pride, humility is the value, and pride is devalued in Christian circles, at least nominally. And I read a book.
He did he's the what he said was the people who are not well off should take pride in where they are, and the people who are well, you see that he like kind of turned it on its head. That was the
Yeah.
only place he used
Okay.
that word. He said the rich should take pride in their humiliation because they're going to pass away like wildflowers.
Interesting. Yeah. There's a book called Choosing God, and I don't remember the subtitle, but it's a pretty approachable and yet academically prepared book about why LGBTQ people who come from conservative theology hold their theology even as they're often rejected by people who share that theology. And they talk about humility and pride as both being values, humble in what you do not know, and proud of who you are and what you are capable of or what you do know. And that, the false use of, for example, the criticism of, and they talk about this in the book, of, well, why, what's all this pride business? Well, because there's a lot to be proud of that other people devalue. And so those are lifted up. But in their daily lives, what these folks, what the theme that came out was, that, to not be ex that they were not going to take a second class citizen place within their w under the teaching of humility,
Okay.
that
Two different
pride
things.
is right, and that you're not a, that they would not allow their pride to be taken from them with humility used as a weapon.
Yes. It's another Another word or phrase for pride would be our identity in God. Okay. I think the word pride carries a lot of baggage, but what is being contrasted here is that you have an identity in God that is beyond compare, that is unimaginably grand and amazing. And that in and of itself is the other side of the coin of humility. Those things are related. You don't have one without the other. They are very much intertwined. Somebody, Marlene.
What I'm hearing you saying, both Martha and Gail, is that kind of pride comes from us seeing ourselves as God sees us. You know, we acknowledge the strengths and the weaknesses, but the innate value and belovedness that God sees us with.
That's a great way to put it. That God is God. Humility is knowing that God is God and we are not. Identity in Christ, identity in God is knowing that we are in the image of God and so very precious. That's powerful stuff.
I want to thank you for bringing up how this was addressed to these communities, because I was thinking earlier about how things were already getting skewed from the very beginning. There's ways that we can just misinterpret, and we need to clarify and course correct where we're headed. And we need to do that often, And they did that from the very get-go. And one thing we talked about in our group was how society needs to change in different ways to be more accepting of people that society considers outliers, not the same as whatever the same is, because I don't even know what that is anymore. There's a lot of Christians out there that hold viewpoints that I just can't get comfortable with. And so I was talking about a situation in our home and in our family where things have changed over the last 60, 70 years for different communities. And Julie was mentioning, we may not see it in our lifetime, but the works we're doing now in trying to make acceptance and understanding and change will have fruit. It just may not be in our lifetime.
Right. Joe, you've had your hand up. I muted you again, so there you go.
Yeah, and I thought I was still muted. I'm so sorry. I don't know
No
what's going
worries.
on. So
Easy for me to do.
thank you. I was sharing that when you said what bubbled up, two things that hit me immediately was the one man on the totem pole. I was like, oh, okay. I mean, because literally how many people feel that, right? And none of us are. But the other thing is that the three together, I just recently took a little class at a request of my therapist, and the concept is that, when you're stuck in something, that what you have to do is do. And it sounds so, but it means like if you're gonna say you're a writer, you gotta write every day. If you're gonna, this, you gotta do it every day. And I read this list and I think I have not been consciously, actively engaged in these concepts and how important it is. Julia just said that society has to change. And I think it starts with each of us doing our due diligence, our work in the faith, the perseverance, and the humility.
Yeah, and that's one of...
It's easy for us to say, you know, on a big whole, but I only get to manage what I do, right? And so every day I'm probably going to be reading. I'm already made a note. I'm going to try to read over this every day and see how it, see if it grow, what it grows.
Right. I just love, I mean, how many people were surprised by James? It was just such a relief to read this little book, and there's no terrible theology in it. You know, I might change a phrase here and there, but it was like, oh yeah, finally, this guy is not speaking to the symptom. He's not talking about, well, the women are talking too much, or the, you know, the hierarchy, the elders aren't good enough, or they don't, you know, or the children don't obey well enough. He does not talking about that stuff. He's speaking to truths rather than to situations or politics. And his words are therefore timeless. This, whoever wrote this, whoever it was a wise man. And just so much here. Martha, you got your hand up.
Thanks. So at the very beginning, you were like, well, who is this James? And you didn't have a conclusion. But I feel like he's a Jew and he's writing to Jews.
Yeah, because... well, certainly from his intro, clearly he is. Yes. Right. And I did not mention that. Thank you for bringing that up.
And it's interesting because it was taken on by the Christian community. Mm-hmm. And what I like about that is its bridge, that we are not that it's the same God, Jesus. Jesus came for a reason. But let's just talk about God for a while. And I found that just really, it's in my Christian scriptures. So I'm like, let's just talk about God for a while. Here we go. We get a little stuck on Jesus. and I think that, getting a chance to meditate on God is
in our New Testament, right? Isn't that beautiful? And isn't it interesting that your point is exactly why Martin Luther couldn't stand this book? I just think that's so revealing about Martin Luther. Was, you know, it didn't talk about Jesus, so he thought it was a letter of straw, you know? And I just think that's a kind of a reflection on him, actually. Because this book is wise. It talks about God.
We expect our writers to have been perfect people, to have had a perfected theology, to have had no theological flaws. And so we twist ourselves inside out and upside down to make certain there is no flaw there.
Yeah.
And the way you describe the disorganization, and granted they didn't have the ability to use, you know, editing tools in a digital format, is these people are working things out. They've put a lot of thought to it before they use the precious resource of a writing tool of some sort, but they're still working it out just like we are.
Yeah.
We got a few years, you know, and few wise people in the interim, but they're working it out. They're trying to figure out who this God is and who am I in relationship with.
Yeah.
God in itself is a pretty beautiful thing.
It is. And I think that disorganization, I was thinking while Julie was talking a minute ago, that the very disorganization that I was seeing in James was because all three of these concepts are so interrelated and they overlap. It's because he couldn't talk about one and not talk about the other two. So it was, that's interesting. Julia.
thinking that, and Martha keeps hitting on the things that I thought early in this Bible study and bringing it back to me. I just did a Bible study by Amy Jo Levine,
Oh, cool.
and it was The Passion of Christ. That's the one I got to lead the class in
She
that one time.
just a second, just to let you guys know who this scholar is. This is a Jewish woman who is a scholar in the New Testament.
Yes. And I was thinking early on when you were presenting that who was James writing to? And like Martha said, he was writing to the Jews, but they also had that inner conflict of they were trying to accept the Gentiles too. And they weren't sure how there was that strife, the Jewish community and the Gentile community. And there was this overreaching umbrella of love to both of them. But how did that work? And like Martha said, well, let's talk about God.
And I, you know what? I've been meaning to say this for a while, but I think as Christians, when we read our New Testament, we would understand the issues a whole lot more if every time we saw the word Gentile, we said pagan. That was the issue.
They came from extremely different foundations, but they were embraced by the theology that Christ was bringing.
If I recall, because a woman made him look that direction.
You're a mess. Brian, we haven't heard from you and we have missed you so much. Do you have anything to add here? You're gonna have to unmute yourself if you do.
Yeah, he makes a lot of good points. I know other places in the Bible it says to not be ostentatious when you pray and all that. So that kind of made me think of James saying, be humble. Like, don't go around being a braggart,
Excellent. All right. Well, oh, Anne's got one more thing.
I just have one question that's been on my mind lately. Joellen and I kind of talked about it. So we all seem to be in agreement that the Jews were God's chosen people. But my question is, if God created Adam and Eve and God created all of us, why did God point to a particular group of people and go, you know what, you guys are the ones that I really like a lot? You wouldn't do that to your children. At least not in front of them. I mean, you have feelings, you know which one's your favorite, but you don't sit there in front of all the others and go, dude, I love your brother, but you guys suck. So, how come we accept this? Because when Christ came and they refused to accept his, and I'm not being anti-Semitic, by the way, when Christ came and they didn't accept his message, then how come they're still the chosen ones?
In any reactions, anyone?
That is the big questions.
You know, one of my part of my understanding was that the point of being quote unquote the chosen people was a way of sort of creating the lineage through which the reparation of damage that had been done at the beginning of humanity's story would come, that there was going to be a specific lineage of people who were learning about God, learning how to follow God. And from that experience and that belief and that history of blessing, as well as, yeah, this is what happens when you wander away, from that came Jesus. I don't know that there is really a theological foundation for the modern church's understanding that the Jewish nation, per se, are still the chosen people now. But that role was there in order to provide a context in which Jesus came enfleshed.
Okay.
Now, I may be totally off on this.
Nope. I mean, I think this is a fabulous question. What do you have,
I do
Martha?
too.
So I'm thinking about that. Anne asked that question kind of in two parts. One was, how could they claim it in the first place? And the second is, why do we still have that as part of our understanding of our faith history? And to the first, it feels like, who's writing the history? And so Jews went through a lot, and God kept providing for them in spite of. So it's not like the victor writes the history, and therefore you get the history via the viewpoint of the victor. But I think you always do have to think about who's doing the writing. This is not somebody outside Judaism writing a history. They're writing their own in their own understanding. And I wonder if there was a, I've got to claim something, got to claim a connection to God that allows me to persevere through all of this. There must be a reason kind of thing. I think what I'm saying is a really, like, probably simplistic and maybe won't hold up very far for it having just come to me, but I would offer that who wrote the book.
Any other
And
observations?
there's other religions in the world that are strong faith in God. They use different words, different names. The indigenous people had their relationships with God. We're not, the Judeo-Christian is not the only belief in the supremeness of God.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and another thing that comes out of this question, and I'm so glad you asked this question, is that I think this concept that has been baked in to a lot of some modern Christian theology about Israel still being the chosen people, and looking, I know we haven't hit Revelation yet, but looking at
Out
the
to
end times as being, the culmination of Israel's chosenness, is this fear right now, and I think very misguided understanding, and that informs national policy, that to call out bad acting on the part of leaders of the country of Israel is to be anti-Semitic and to be against God, because anything the Jews do has to be okay. Anything Israel, the nation of Israel, does, differentiating between the Jewish people and the country of Israel, anything that Benjamin Netanyahu and his cohorts do, we have to bless because the Jews are God's chosen people and we can't go against that.
Right. Joe?
So here's the thing. I just heard the thing about, different groups and have the, and we've talked about before that maybe there's just many paths and we're just on one and that's all we see. But I know that many years ago, in one of the sixth grade thematic units we were doing, one of the classes did, they handed the kids a sheet, that had, like, what was it, like five, six, I don't remember the number, major religions, and had them lift, who was the leader, what was the book, and what were the main tenets. And kids, it didn't take them long, wasn't that hard to see that almost all the tenets are the same. They're all right. So if we're all talking about, like, who wrote the book and how we have, and I'm not disagreeing with you, Martha, I agree, but I'm just saying, 2,000 years later, we're still choosing this
a book of why are we not expanding as we sit here and say we're all God's children? I guess that's one of the things we're still studying. Yeah, a book rooted in, like Anne was saying, the chosen people.
Why does it feel like we are treading on dangerous soil to even talk about needing to recognize God in other people and places and ways, right?
Yes.
This it's even it's so ingrained in us that this is a scary topic, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that Martha is on the right track in that the Bible, start to finish, Hebrew Bible all the way through to the New Testament, was the Jews' cultural story. And the core that Anne called out is this whole idea of being elect or chosen. And why are there, is there this one group called out, you know, as being elect or chosen? But it's important, I think, to look at what they were elected and chosen to be. They were elected and chosen to bless everyone else. They were elected and chosen to basically channel God, right? To become so close to God that they would live out the heart of God among their siblings, that they would, that we would all receive God like by osmosis from being, you know, from their faithfulness and their, so that God could sh use them to show who he was. Does that make sense? That God would use them to show his, how his blessings, how he prospers us. Now, I'm not talking prosperity gospel, but how he grows us and heals us, how being in proximity to him changes things and is different than the other things that we clung to and said were God. So this didn't happen in a vacuum. God didn't just like pluck out, you know, a people in a vacuum. He plucked out a man who was living in Ur of the Chaldees. He was living in the heart of one of the most ancient Babylonian civilizations, Chaldean civilizations in the world, who had an embedded religious structure. And God called, spoke to this man because this man's heart was receptive to him. One that he was special in any other way. It was that this man's heart was receptive. And God said, I want you out of there. I want you out of the environment that you're in. I want to take you completely out of that to something completely new and different because I am going to show you a new and different God. And through that, through your descendants, who you will teach about this new and different God, everybody's going to be blessed because people won't have to follow things that are death dealing. I think we are having this discussion in an environment that we are perceiving as death dealing, right? And we are talking about being the kind of person in our environment nowadays who is called out to show that my God is a different kind of God than that. I'm a different kind of Christian than that. Okay? It's this, these are not dissimilar. So when God says chosen or elect, I think that's all he's talking about. I think that these stories are all written from their viewpoint. I think we could all be chosen. What if we are all chosen
Did it get
to
their
be a blessing to all the nations? What if the culmination of this election is the Great Commission? What if the
nothing else?
culmination of this is Jesus saying, "You go do it. Go tell everybody that they are elect and chosen by God."
So that's where I think maybe we have diverged off the path. And I shared the story with you guys once before, but when Amanda, who was really strong in church and youth leader, had a very good friend in high school who died, and she's Muslim. She had a heart defect that nobody knew. She was on a treadmill at home by herself, and she died. And Amanda, in tears, is, "Mom, she's not Christian, and I cannot handle the thought that she's in hell because she's not a Christian." And so Anne and I have talked about some of these things for a long time. I think a lot of us have had some thoughts or doubts that circulate. We're not sure what to do with them. But that was the first time I think that as a person, as a mom, I was called to answer. And what I came up with is that I think, what if it's the light in man that is attracted to the light in you and vice versa, and that this isn't. But I think we've taken the chosen thing and turn it into a silo, or some people have turned it into a silo and a
Yes, I
weapon.
don't think it was ever intended to be that.
And so it's just taken, I know myself, for a long time to get here, to see that my endeavor, my mission, whatever, is different than what I thought it was. I mean, just like the Fishers of Men thing. But I have a friend here who every day is sending me stuff about how, and it's particularly because in a place where I used to live, there was this large area of land that was supposedly sold. It was going to make a big Muslim land. And, I keep getting all this stuff from her about the harm of it. And I keep encouraging her to embrace an open dialogue and share that, if anything, my daughter being in foreign lands and getting to travel there has taught me that we're all people. We're all pretty much the same. We get up in the morning, we want to do the best we can, we want to provide for our kids, we want to be loved. And all the messages we're getting is part of a war or a weapon. And
Right.
yeah, and I guess for me, maybe this is the biggest takeaway at this point that I'm having from our classes, and I'm feeling very grateful and perhaps seeing things differently than I ever have.
That's amazing that my heart is responding to that. It's just that we can take this, what you described as everything is a war, and we can just step out of that. Say, no, I'm not, that's not where I dwell.
This reminds me of something I read many years ago, and I'm going to just throw it out there and see if anybody reads this. Have y'all read On God by Spinoza? He's a Jewish
Super famous,
theologian,
though. Super famous, though.
super famous Jewish theologian, and he wrote a piece called On God, and it questions everything. And it's short and it's very interesting, and it has come to mind today. But it
Well, that'll be
doesn't
our
shake
homework
my faith.
assignment. All right. We have gone way past time, but it was such an important question, Anne. Thank you for asking that. Lots of food for thought. Love you all. And we will dive into First John next week. See what that one is. Love you. Bye.
Thanks. Love you.
Right, everybody.
Bye.